Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have back here on the program Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is with us once a month. It's always on Monday, and we talk about home maintenance. And this is your opportunity to call in and ask questions if you have some problem around the house. You're not quite sure how to deal with it. You can give us a call and tell us about it, and Scott will do his best to help you out. And we have talked about just about everything that goes into a home in the past. Certainly, we've talked about heating and cooling. We've talked about insulation, windows, doors, siding, roofing, basements, gutters. And you get the idea. So, you got a question for us, and we already have a couple of people lined up here. We'd be happy to take them. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much.
Good morning, David. Always a pleasure to be here.
We will not wait. We'll just get right to it. And we have a caller to start out with in St. Joe, and they are on line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a house that's about 150 years old, and of course we've got some problems. But one of the problems I'm trying to handle is cracking windowsills. And what I'm doing is I'm removing the stain or any other coats of stuff with an arbor sander, and then I'm countersinking any nails or as necessary. Then I use a wood filler to fill the miscellaneous holes. But unfortunately, when I apply stain, it barely penetrates the wood filler, and I have gray colored spots underneath the stain. And I just wondered if you had any recommendations for filling holes with material that will absorb the stain comparable to wood, and if you have any recommendations on a different procedure.
Well, first of all, if you're sanding the old sills, I'm hoping that they're a shellacked or a varnished sill and not a painted sill, because the house is old enough, you've probably got a pretty good accumulation of lead-based paint if there's any really glossy type paint on the trim boards.
Okay.
And if that's the case, then you have to be very careful when you're sanding that we're not getting lead dust into the house. And do you want to use a mask or something to?
Right, I've got that.
Okay. There are several different varieties and types of wood fillers out there, and some are more absorbent for stains and such. Once you've gotten into wood fillers, it's really difficult to get a good match, because the filler will absorb the stain at a different rate than the wood, so that you're not going to get a good color match. It's going to be a matter of trial and error. What color filler do you need to go with your stain? So I'd probably get a board and try a couple of things for whatever color stain you happen to be using. It also depends on how much shellac or how much paint got onto the sill as to how deep it's sealed, as to how much stain it's going to take. So it's the wood's going to take stain depending on what's just below the surface at a certain rate, and then your wood filler is going to take stain at a different rate. So yes, it is going to be difficult to match. I'm afraid I don't have any really good suggestions for that.
Okay, I was afraid of that. Well, do you have any recommendations for a different procedure than what I'm doing with the sanding and so forth?
Well, I assume, are we talking about the interior or exterior sills?
Interior
sills. No, that's probably about your best method, is to somehow scrape or sand all the old paint off of it. If you're going to put a stain or leave it natural, no, I think you're doing it probably about correctly.
Okay, and I'm using a urethane.
Okay, so you're sealing it up pretty much permanently, so you don't have to do it again.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the urethane, you can put the urethane over. You're using a urethane that already has the stain built into it?
No, I'm using a two-step procedure.
Put okay.
The filler, the stain, and then I'm using the urethane.
Yeah. Okay, well, that should seal them up quite nicely.
Okay. Other question, on where I do have the significant problems with the wood filler, and the wood filler is a gray color material, even though I put a lot of stain on top of it, several coats, is still coming through. And I'm thinking about just sanding down the urethane and applying some brown paint over those sills. Is there a problem with putting latex over urethane after some sanding?
The urethane is not going to want to stick to a latex paint. The latex paint has a lot of flexibility to it, and the latex just isn't, or the urethane is just not going to adhere well to it. So I don't think that process will work well.
How about if I prime it?
Put the urethane, or the, now, well, if you're painting it, why are you putting the urethane over the top of it?
Oh, no. Where I put the urethane on it, there's one set of windowsills that where the wood filler just looks horrendous on top of the stain or through the stain and the urethane.
Okay.
So now I'm thinking, well, maybe I just ought to paint those. And so I thought I'd just paint a dark brown. And but then I thought, well, I was concerned about adhesion. And I thought, well, maybe I could just sand it and prime it and then apply urethane.
As long as you get the primer, get a good sand before you put the primer on, yes, it should hold.
Okay, good. Okay. Thanks, Scott.
All right, sure. Thank you. Let's go on to line number two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a house with plaster and lath walls that I would like to mount bookshelves on. I've done some exploration and found out where on this particular wall where I'd like to mount the shelves, where the studs are, and guess what? They're not. The shelves I have are 4 foot wide, and guess what? There aren't two studs 4 foot apart anywhere near there. I found one, and then I found one 2 feet away, and then I didn't find another one anywhere near 4 feet. So I was wondering, and of course their location isn't exactly the most desirable for the mounting of the shelves. I haven't been able to find the information online about the using of the star type wall anchors is acceptable for plaster and lath. It'll actually hold anything, because these bookshelves are probably going to have, many hundreds of pounds of books on them, and plus the weight of the shelves and the wall strips that they're mounted to and so forth. So is that acceptable, or do you have some idea or know some sort of fastening system that would work?
Okay. First of all, you need to verify, are you working with a metal lath or a wood lath behind the plaster?
Wood, I think. I haven't been able to get it and find out. I keep I used a small masonry bit to punch test holes in the wall to see where I could find studs. And it felt like I was hitting plaster and then lath and going through that, because it would go right. The masonry bit would go through the plaster fairly readily and then hit a resistance, and then I could pop through that. I haven't found anything that looked like metal yet, but I don't know absolutely for sure whether it is metal or wood. I'm thinking it's wood because the house is, 60 years old or so.
Usually on a house that has a plaster coating over a wood lath, there's some areas you can see, usually basement stairways, or if you look inside around pocket doors, there's usually some place that you can get to where you can look behind it and actually see where the lath is. If nothing else, you pop your head up in the attic and pull the insulation back and see what you've got for the ceiling.
Okay.
And if it is indeed a wood lath, then you're actually in pretty good shape. I would not necessarily use one of the star anchors, but you can use basically just a general wood screw, because the wood is a pretty solid material behind there. Ideally, you want to try and get one or two into the stud if you can, but not every bracket would have to go into the stud. You could just screw right into the wood lath. Now, if you've got a plaster back or either a metal sheathing or a metal screen that they put up there, or if they used effectively drywall as a backer, then you're going to have to come up with an anchoring system. But if it's actually wood back there, the wood screws will bite into the lath, and the lath is pretty strong, and it should hold things up.
Oh, you think so, huh? Okay, good. Well, I'll verify that, and thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Bye.
Next caller up is somebody on a cell phone. This is line three. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
We are needing to replace a water heater. Well, at least we think we're to that point. It's a natural gas water heater, and I was wondering if I could get your thoughts on the tankless water heaters that seem to be getting popular these days.
Well, the tankless are nice units. Now, you have to size them so that they can provide you an appropriate temperature drop. The tankless systems are designed to take whatever the water temperature coming in this area. Let's take a number of approximately 50 to 52 degrees or so coming up out of the ground and heat it up to whatever it is that we're trying to run, which generally speaking is about 120 to 125 degrees. So we need to be able to get something with that 70 degree temperature increase. So if you size it properly, they work well. They're a little more expensive to install. It's one of those things where I'm not completely 100% sold on them for retrofitting older houses unless you've got ventilation issues. In other words, if you've got an old brick chimney you want to use, you might want to run one of these new induced draft units although they make those in a tank style as well.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, what I have found here lately, I get into doing an inspection on a house that's vacant, and the homeowner has basically turned the water heater to the pilot light only setting so that they didn't use any gas while the house was vacant. And the temperature is actually higher in the tank than what the setting would be on the water heater, because the pilot light was enough to keep the water in the tank hot. Since nobody was drawing it. So obviously the tank is well enough insulated that we're really not losing a lot of heat through those tanks. So the tankless are great for space saving. They're great for additions. For the cost-wise, I'm not sure how quickly you're going to recover over a tank unit if you've got a place or you've already got one installed or one that are going to retrofit.
That's one of the things, too, we're looking at is how long we're going to be in the house. Do you know how they impact the sale value of a home? Do they help? Do they hurt? Or is it just a matter of...
They don't really hurt. It's one of those things where you have to make sure you keep the paperwork there, because a lot of people are not educated on them. So when somebody sees something new in a house, usually they're curious, oh, why is this here? The units work quite nicely. I've recommended them in several instances particularly for additions where the bathrooms are extremely far away from the main tank. How many people are in the house? How many people are in your house?
No, two.
Okay. Yeah, the tankless one should work quite well. Usually when I find a house that's a 3-4-bedroom, yes, a tankless will work, but you have to have such a large burner to make sure that you've got enough capacity that I sometimes question whether or not, from an economical standpoint, you couldn't get away with just using one of the 50 or 75-gallon tank units.
Okay.
In other words, yes, I think they work great. I'm not quite sure they're the milk and cookies that everybody claims they're going to be because the standard tank units are getting more and more efficient. So I'm going to say the jury's still out on this, but it's definitely something to consider.
Do you know anywhere where I can find ratings on water heaters, the tank? Because I've looked everywhere, including Consumer Reports, and they just don't seem to rank various brands, and I really have no idea, where to look on something like that or what is, considered a better than the other.
I have not tried to find anything like that. I'm sure that there's something out there. It's actually something I'd probably put my father on, so he does most of my research for me. He's got some contacts from the university that are usually pretty good at things like that. So try and give us a call later this afternoon over at the Home Inspection Service, and I'll see what I can come up with for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's with us once a month on a Monday to talk about home maintenance, answer questions just like these. So if you have some problem, you're not quite sure how to solve it, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. If you were going to go out and buy a water heater today, obviously the efficiency that is available for purchase is much better than what has been in the past. Are we pretty much now all going to the high-efficiency heaters and the kind that, rather than venting into a chimney, as a lot of people probably still do, we have the kind that where they're venting the flue gases, there's a powered sort of vent, and it's just vented out the side of the house?
Well, it kind of depends on your application. If we get an older home that has a brick chimney that has a liner or a questionable liner, then yes, I usually do recommend you go to one of the power vent units, and they are slightly more efficient. If you've already got a system in and you're just replacing a tank that is limed up or not working well or possibly leaking, then it kind of depends on whether or not it's worth the extra money. You can buy usually in the $400 range without installation one of the standard water heaters. The direct vent units are going to be closer to $700 to $800. So you've got to have an awful lot of savings to make up for the difference, not to mention the difference in install, because if you've got one of the newer power vent units, you've got to change all the venting, you've got to drill holes in the outside wall and run your PVC pipe. So there is an initial cost that is a little bit higher. Once you've got that in there, then you know the cost of the unit is not all that much different, and it does save you some money. But I'm not sure that it would. It kind of depends on your installation. If you've got to go 40 feet with PVC pipe and tear out a finished basement wall or ceiling to get through it, I'm not sure that the direct vent or the PVC vented pipe is going to or water heater is going to give you enough savings to do that much work. Mm-hmm. But if you've got an unlined chimney or something like that, then yes, they are definitely worth it because it's going to be cheaper to put in a direct vent or an induced draft water heater than it would be to put in a chimney liner.
Okay. The caller's here. Next, we'll talk with someone in Piatt County, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm fixing up a small old house. I call it a cottage, and I'm fixing it up for a workshop. And visually, it's been sitting out in the country, so it has asbestos shingles, and they're just filthy. And I would rather clean it than paint it. Someone said that you could use a pressure washer on it, but then someone said that it would break the shingles off, the old, you know, asbestos shingles. And so I was wondering if one can spray, high-pressure spray, clean asbestos shingles. Would they break? And then isn't there a compound that they use for washing houses?
Okay, are we talking about asbestos siding or asbestos roofing?
Siding.
Okay, the siding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, usually siding boards are fairly hard board,
mm-hmm.
And they can be cleaned. I probably would not use the really ultra-high pressure units. Mm-hmm. You know, you start getting up over 2,500 PSI, 3,000 PSI, we can start blasting water actually back through behind the shingles and get things wet.
Okay.
And get the water in the insulation. You really shouldn't need to use the high pressure if they're... The shingles will tend to pick up a little bit of dirt. You can probably do it with a garden hose and a nylon brush. They're a pretty durable shingle.
Mm-hmm.
If you hit them with anything, of course, they're brittle.
Mm-hmm.
The asbestos is encased in a thin concrete board. The asbestos is used as a reinforcement fiber for the concrete board.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start breaking off pieces, you can get some asbestos airborne.
Mm-hmm.
You can paint them as well. The asbestos shingles, they do make an Alka Grip or a paint designed for asbestos shingles, which would help correct some of it. But if it's just dirt, I would probably get a nylon brush like what you'd use, get at one of the RV centers for doing your motorhome. They have a nice long handle on it and a
mm-hmm.
hook up to a garden hose, and you should be able to just use a soap and water solution to get most of it off.
Is there a solution like they use for siding? Was it a TCP or?
I don't know that would work well with the asbestos shingles. I mean, that works well on more for your vinyl sidings,
right. Uh-huh.
Which are non-porous, and the
yeah.
the asbestos has just a little bit more porosity to it.
Okay.
So I'm not sure that I'd want to use that.
Okay, I was just hoping. So is there a specific cleaner or just a siding cleaner?
Most of the detergents will work well. Just it doesn't have to be a specific cleaner for the asbestos, but I would try and stay away from any harsh chemicals.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your help.
Okay. Thank you. Well, let's go to Dwight. This is the next caller, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I wondered if you were familiar with touch plate lighting.
Touch plate lighting?
Or where they have the 24-volt switches, and then there's a relay in the...
Oh, yes, yes.
Do you know where you can get the relays?
Well, it's getting harder and harder to find. I just had to pick up a few of them the other day and found them online. I was able to do a search on eBay and found several of them on eBay. But there are still some available. Usually the electric stores I know here in town can order them. They don't necessarily keep them in stock. I'm assuming you're talking about the old GE system.
You run a hot lead to one wire and it turns it on, and then a hot lead to another wire.
And it turns it off. So all your switches, you'd hit the top and it turns them on. And you can have multiple switches on one light.
Right.
And then your relays are either mounted in a central panel in the basement or on individual fixtures.
They're on individual fixtures, yeah.
Okay. The relays and the switches are still available. I do believe Springfield Electric here in town can get them. But my father's house actually has that entire system set up, and we've got all the relays in one central location down the basement. And I just went online and did a search on eBay and was able to find several of them for a nice, reasonable price.
Oh, I haven't had any luck finding them locally anywhere, and I hadn't tried the internet for.
Yeah, locally is going to be hard to do because there were only a few houses done. It's something that was used pretty much back in the late 50s, early 60s. It was going to be the new wave thing. It was going to be every house was going to have this new electronic device, and then it kind of fizzled out.
Yeah.
But, yes, they are still available. If you absolutely just can't find one, let me know, and I've got one or two of them. I'm sure we can try and fix something up for you.
Okay. Or you said Springfield Electric there in Champaign?
Yeah, they can usually order that stuff.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, sure. Thanks. Now, you're going to have to explain to me what this is because I'm not sure that I know.
It's a low-voltage switching system. Mm-hmm. Each individual light switch is actually a 24-volt system, and it turns a relay on, and the relay turns the light on and off. And that way you can have multiple switches throughout the house. You know, you're familiar with three-way switches.
Right.
Well, you can actually get 7-8 switches that turn on one light. One of the nice things about it was they came out with a 10-position switch, a rotary switch, a big dial, and then an on-off alongside of it. And you push the top or the on button, and you rotate that dial, and you can turn on 10 houses or 10 lights in the house. So you put one at like the front door and the back door and the master bedroom. So in your middle of the night, you hear something go thump. You can reach above your bed, spin the dial, and you turn on 10 different lights in the house to find out what's going on. Or when you come in the evening through the front or back door, you could spin it and turn them all on.
Mm-hmm.
But let's see, the system that we have in my father's house, actually every bedroom has three light switches. One is for the overhead light, one is for the wall, and one is for the hallway. So our hallway light has, with the bathroom and three bedrooms, has four different switches plus one at the beginning of the hallway. So there's a total of five switches. And instead of having one have to be down to turn the light on, the switching system, when you hit the top of the light goes on. You hit the bottom of the switch, rather, and the switch goes, the light goes off.
Mm-hmm.
So it just, everything is, the switches are controlling a relay, and the relay is controlling the light.
Oh, okay. Well, very good. Well, let's go on here. We'll talk with next someone in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for the program. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy it. I have a question. I'm the president of a condo unit, condo association. And one of the ladies in a fourplex, a middle unit, is complaining that her condo has settled and she can't lock her door. I have suggested that it would be good for her to contact a professional locksmith to see what's going on with her door. But she's convinced that there is a major structural problem. I'm wondering, does the home inspector, if I contacted somebody like you, I mean, could they look at the foundation and see if that's the problem?
Yes, I could look at it, or so any home inspector should be able to look at it. That would be a good place to start because they're a neutral party. They're not there to try and sell you something to fix the problem. They're there to determine what the problem is and help you figure out what the best way to do it. So, yes, a problem call or a maintenance inspection is something that could be done to help determine it.
Is that a common problem in this area with the freezing and thawing and the house? I mean, would a middle condo unit have that kind of a problem, do you think?
Well, I doubt very, very seriously that there's actually a foundation settlement.
Okay.
The foundations are usually pretty solid. There's a few places where we get soft enough soil, we can get that much movement. But for the most part, what I found in Champaign County and the surrounding areas is we've had just very, very few places where we've had enough soil movement or viscosity to displace foundations. However, it's not uncommon to get wood shrinkage and movement and get doorways out of square, particularly if one side of the door is near a foundation wall and the other side of the door heads towards the center support. When we build a wood frame house, we set the floor joist on the sill plate or the concrete block on the outside on your band joist area. And then your inside of your floor joist sits on top of a wood beam. Well, if the wood beam shrinks and the floor joist shrinks, where it sits on the wood beam, we can actually get about double the amount of shrinkage we're going to get to on a foundation wall.
It's logical then that the inability to close the door may be something structural rather than just a lock going out of alignment.
Well, the lock going out of alignment is, generally speaking, something has moved. Yes, I'm sure we've got some wood movement someplace. Whether or not it's actually a true structural problem, it's due to structural movement. But wood does expand and contract with temperature changes, and particularly on new construction, you'll get quite a bit of shrinkage in the first 1 to 2 years.
Yeah, and, well, they're about 20 years old.
Okay. There could be something interesting going on, such as water damage around a door that could be causing the problem. There's any number of different things. The locksmith is probably not going to be the person to fix it. It's probably going to require a carpenter, but that would be a good reason to have somebody come out and take a look at it that has no interest in doing the repair, just so you can get the correct analysis of what's actually going wrong.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It's been very helpful.
Very good. Thank you. Okay. Well, we're at our midpoint here. This is our monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies is our guest from the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he's here once a month. It's always on a Monday. We talk about maintenance issues, and if you have a question, you have a problem, give us a call, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, just before we got going here, we were talking about the fact that it is, in fact, getting warmer, and that if people haven't, people haven't yet turned on their air conditioner, but it may not be all that long before people are going to start turning them on. In terms of pre-season maintenance or checks, what would you suggest that people be doing?
Depending on how old or how new the system is, you may want to get somebody to come out and take a look at it. This is actually a really good time to have the furnace and air conditioning system serviced, because it's warm enough that they are able to actually run the air conditioner. They're not quite busy yet. Most of the service guys, while they're keeping busy, we're not ending up with a big heat spell where everybody calls up and says, oh, my air conditioner's broke. So they're not quite as busy right now, so usually you can get on the schedule. Definitely, if nothing else, I would recommend getting the filters changed. I try and do that 3 or 4 times a year or more, and the switch of the season is always a good time. If you've got an older air conditioner, if your air conditioner is, say, 15 years old or older, I would seriously consider getting some pricing on some new units. The older air conditioners had a lower SEER rating, or seasonal energy efficiency rating. The new ones available right now are a 13 SEER, which refers to the number of BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. An older unit, say in the 16 to 18 year old range, quite likely is a 6 SEER. So you literally will cut your air conditioning bill in half by switching to one of the newer units. So if you've got an older one, even though it's still in functional condition, a new air conditioner is probably not a bad idea, particularly as our energy prices are going up, which from the report just before our show this morning, it sounds like things are going to be going a little higher yet.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go talk next with someone in Lafayette on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about cleaning the furnace duct through the house? Is that worth doing?
In rare occasions, yes. It's one of those things where there's been some research on it. Generally speaking, most of the ducts, as long as they were relatively clean during construction. Now, I know a lot of times, particularly if they're in the floor, things get swept into them. They get quite dirty. But cleaning them doesn't seem to help. Are you cleaning it because of allergies or?
Possibly allergies, yes.
Yeah. If you've got a lot of allergies and you feel that there's been some humidity problems in the ducts, they do have some cleaning systems that will help clean them out. The reports that I've seen, even some government reports, really don't show a large reduction in the number of allergens after the cleaning as versus before the cleaning. Somewhat, but not a lot. So I'm not 100% sold on the duct cleaning. I know that there are cases where it does help. So I can't say, no, don't do it. But it's not one of the things that would be high on my priority list. I would probably be more interested in upgrading the filter system so that the air moving through the system has a better filtering. What kind of filter do you have in there now?
I have an electronic filter.
You do have an electronic filter. Okay, well, that should help. And that should have stopped most of your particles from ever really getting in there. So the only thing we'd have to worry about is if there was dirt in the ductwork and then we had a moisture source where we could actually start growing some mold spores and allergens. Hopefully the crawl space is dry and basement is dry, and so the ducts are not getting that moisture source. But if there's some place where they're damp or wet, then it's not a bad idea.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right. And again, we'll go to someone here in Indiana, Putnam County, Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hot water heater issue. Hot water heater that's LP gas, about 10 years old. It's a power vent, horizontal vent.
Okay.
And there's a vacuum tube that leads from the venting motor down to the gas valve so that it, you know, it knows that it has exhaust. That tube is accumulating water, and I'm wondering where it's coming from and what I can do to get rid of it. When it gets to have too much water, then it blocks the tube, of course, and the valve won't come on.
Right. That's a pressure differential tube so that the induction fan says it's running. I've got enough low pressure that it actually signals the gas valve to turn on.
Right.
Does it have a loop or something in it that the water's collecting in?
There's a small bend in it as it comes out of the water heater and goes up to the fan, the power fan. Once the water's actually collecting in the tube that's inside the water heater itself, but the water vapor seems to condense in this the plastic part of the tube, which is outside the tank, and when it gets to be enough, it forms a little bubble of water in there and blocks the vacuum.
Yeah, there sounds to me like there's something wrong with a check valve someplace. Where your water's coming from is apparently you're actually drawing enough that we're pulling a little bit of the flue gases from the top down to the bottom. And as we pull those flue gases through, there's some moisture in. Anytime you burn a flame, one of the byproducts is a water vapor. And it sounds like we're actually drawing some of the flue gases back down through your pressure tube, which makes me wonder if the pressure switch has a hole in a diaphragm or something like that that's allowing that moisture in there. I think it probably is time for a service call because you should not be getting condensation in that tube.
Okay. Well, it is 10 years old, so that's possible.
Yeah, it sounds to me like a pressure switch problem because really while we should be getting a pressure differential, we shouldn't actually be drawing flue gases down through the tube.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the only way you're going to get the condensation in there is if we're actually pulling some of those flue gases down.
Okay. All right.
Well, thank you. Hopefully that takes care of it.
Next caller is in Wellington, line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Yeah. I just turned my radio on a minute ago and heard you talking something about maybe air filters.
Yes.
Or furnaces, and wife and I are just appalled at how much dust we have with our forced air furnace in the house, and the basement is very, very dry, and the crawl space, we have a new crawl space, a new addition, and it has bisqueen in there and everything, so I would think it's going to be real dry, too. But what kind of filters can one purchase to eliminate the excessive dust?
Okay, are we just trying to eliminate dust? Are we worried about allergens and pollens, things like that?
Well, I don't know. Probably just the dust, I guess.
Okay.
I don't know. We don't necessarily have a lot of allergies.
Okay. The primary filter systems that you'll see generally available at most of your big box stores or even your grocery stores are a fiberglass filter. Those fiberglass filters usually will only filter out about somewhere between 15% and 20% of the pollutants in the air. You can get a little bit better with the cotton filters. Usually they look like a white fabric. They're a little bit better. They will usually take somewhere in the 40% to 50% range. They make a paper filter, I commonly referred to as a box filter. It's actually, instead of being 1 inch thick, it's 3 inches thick and has about anywhere from 50 to 80 square feet of filter paper in there. Sort of looks like a pleated paper like your car air filter would look like. And those are actually up in the 70% range. If you want to get much more above 70% where we start taking out tree pollens and grass pollens and things like that, then you move to one of the electrostatic units. But the electrostatic units are relatively expensive to install, and they do require a little higher maintenance, a little washing and things like that. One of the box filters, which usually sell for about $15 to $20 for the filter, you replace it about once a year. So they're really not all that cost prohibitive. Usually the box or the filter rack to hold it is not all that difficult to install. So usually you can get one for a few hundred dollars, get a box filter system. They make a couple of nice contained ones. Space Guard makes one. There's an Air Bear. Usually those filters installed with the filter box and everything around the $600 or $700 range, whereas the electronic ones can be almost double that. I would probably start with one of the disposable $4 or $5 filters or even an $8 filter rather than one of the $2 or $3 filters and see if that helps. One of the pleated Filtreat by 3M is a good one. One of the things you have to worry about on filters is that we can filter out just about everything. Unfortunately, when we do that, we can't get any air through it. And the less air we get through the system, the less efficiency we have through the system. So you have to make sure that as we get to the better filters that we have more surface area so that we are not restricting the airflow through the furnace. So we're not reducing the efficiency of the furnace.
My furnace will only take one-inch thick filter.
Yeah, so to start with, I would try and get one of the, just to upgrade the filter you're putting in there. Instead of putting in a fiberglass filter, put in one of the fabric filters, one of the cotton filters.
Yeah, what I've been using is, I think it's made by 3M, and it's two layers of more like foam rubber.
Okay.
And I take them out and I sweep them out, or I can't even wash them and then put them back in.
Yeah. I would try one of their, just for an experiment on your part, one of their Filtreat systems, which is the white, almost a cotton-like cloth that works quite well. I think it has a little bit finer porosity than what the foam does. The foam has a little bit wider cell to it, so you can get a little bit more dust through it.
And is that a pleat that is close together, or I've seen some in that are fairly cheap that don't look like they would be any better. The pleat is like an inch apart. Are you talking a pleat more like a car air filter that's close together?
Well, the close together pleated units are usually the thicker units, which aren't going to fit in there without some modification.
Right.
So I would probably try one of the 1-inch units, which will have a little bit wider pleat to it, but still has a fairly good airflow. And see if that helps your dust problem. Say if it does not help your dust problem. Most of the dust is not actually coming from the furnace. The furnace is going to be pulling air in from the house and blowing it back out the other side, and the dust doesn't originate there. You might want to start looking for other sources in the house, leaky windows, drafty windows, threshold under a door that doesn't seal tight, something like that that's actually letting the dust in the house, because the furnace doesn't create the dust. The furnace, just because there's air moving, does tend to help distribute it, but there is always a dust source.
Yeah, I see. We've got all new replacement windows, and I assume that it's just once it's there, it's a constant circulation. We also had the ducts cleaned a couple years ago.
Okay. Did that seem to help?
Not really, no.
Okay, well then probably your best bet is to try one of the pleated paper or the cotton type filters, and if that doesn't go, doesn't seem to help much, then you'll probably have to contact your furnace man and move up to one of the box type filters with the paper.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. I think that people will be surprised if you go out to wherever it is that you buy these kinds of things, hardware store, big box store, and look at those filters, the standard ones that are 1 inch thick that are just made to slip into your furnace. First of all, there's a wide range in price. You can buy really cheap ones, or you can buy ones that might seem to be expensive. But what you're doing as you're spending more money is you're getting more filtering power. So if you have that kind of a problem and you're using a low-end filter, well, as you say, you just might at one time go and upgrade. Get one of those that has more filtering power. Put that in there and see how that does for you. But don't leave it in there for 6 months.
Right.
You don't want to do that either.
Yeah, the more expensive filters, they do filter better, but because they have the smaller pores in them, they do tend to block up more rapidly. And when they block up, then we start reducing the efficiency of the furnace. So they have to be changed more often. Mm-hmm. My father has always said that a good air filter is sort of like a good cheese. It keeps getting better and better with age until it gets so good you have to throw it away.
Yeah, I know that joke. I've heard that joke more than once. So that's a good thing to keep in mind. We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he's here once a month on the show. It's a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'll ask a question and make a comment, and I'll hang up. I heard on a talk show years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, that most American return air ductworks on their forced air furnaces were half the square area they should be. They'd increase their efficiency if their ductwork were quite a bit larger or double the size. And then I've always taken something like a janitor's damp mop treatment and sprayed down the various filters I've put in to increase their efficiency, and I'll just hang up.
Well, I could I can see where that would be effective, something like an end dust type product that you'd use on a duster to try and attract dirt. It's got a little bit of adhesive. Something like that sprayed onto a lesser expensive filter would help trap a little bit more of the dust and dirt. Again, you're going to have to replace the filter more often when it does something like that. As far as a return air, well, I can't argue that point. Generally speaking, a furnace is only as efficient as how much air we can move through it. In order to move air, you have to be able to pull it from one side of the furnace and blow it to the other side, and any restriction anywhere can reduce the efficiency. When you get a furnace and it has an efficiency rating on it, usually they're not connecting it up to a lot of ductwork. They're just taking the efficiency across the system, across the heat exchanger itself. I have seen an awful lot of older houses that have had really large ducts, but not necessarily placed in the right spot. The old school of thought was, hey, if the wall is cold and the window is cold, then the cold air falling down there, we're going to put our return register there to collect that cold air, take it back to the furnace, and blow the warm air back in the center of the room, which worked well for the furnace, but it made the room uncomfortable because your body acts as a radiant heater. And if you stand next to that wall that was colder, then you felt cold in the room, so it was hard to get a good comfort zone in the house. So now we switch it around and go the other direction. We put the warm air in the floor underneath the window or at the cold wall and put a warm air barrier between you and the cool source. So now you feel comfortable in the room, and we put the return airs usually in heating areas such as Illinois. Or central Illinois, the returns are usually high in a wall. But some of these older systems, they've been retrofit. The returns may be in the floor and not necessarily near the inside wall, so you don't get the optimum circulation. So I'm not going to disagree with it. There are a lot of systems out there that could use a lot better return air system. And return air ducts is a rule. Metal type ducts, they have a lot of air leakage, so they're pulling air from wherever they're running through, whether it be an attic or a crawl space, things like that. So some engineering will definitely make a difference on how efficient the furnace is.
If you could do it, would it make sense to put a filter on your return air duct so that the air would be going through this filter before then it would get to the furnace?
Well, effectively, that's what you're already doing. Depending on whether your filter is in a grill in the ceiling or whether the filter is in the duct right next to the furnace, yes, we are filtering the return air before it gets to the filter. Otherwise, your air conditioner coil becomes the next filter, so you don't really want to run one without a filter. Hmm. It doesn't really matter where you put the filter as long as all the air is going through the filter. But you can also put in too many filters, get one at the return air grill and one at the furnace, and start reducing our airflow. And that means we have to increase the fan speed or do something to make up for the restriction.
Okay. Caller here in Lafayette, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have one more question about filtering. Can you reflect on using an ultraviolet light in the ductwork air intake before, like, let's say, a box filter?
The UV lights are reported to help take care of some of the germs and bacteria that can grow. There are different studies as to just how effective they are. I'm not going to go into it too much because there's an awful lot of information that I'm not sure how trustworthy it is, but there's an awful lot of information that seems to be quite reliable. It's something I would have to do more research for, I'd say much more on it. I'm not completely sold on the units because I'm not sure just how much bacteria is in there that we're trying to kill off. If you read the advertisement brochure, we're saving the world by installing one of those. But some of the actual production reports I found that just haven't been supported everything that the sales claims have been making.
Okay, we have about maybe 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Scott Spies. You have a home question, home maintenance question. Give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about this is now the time to think about having your air conditioner checked, really, before you want it really going. And while you're at it, I suppose the person who does that could also take a look at the furnace. You could do both those things. Just make sure everything is in proper working order. So that's maybe one thing that you want to put on your spring checklist of things to do. Anything else that you might suggest at this time of year people be thinking about?
Well, the old standby. Check those gutters. This is the time that we're getting all the tree debris, the buds from the flowers and things like that. Make sure the gutters get cleaned out and make sure they get extended out in a way. It's one of those things where I almost get tired of telling the same story over and over. Check the gutters, check the grating. But every week I go back to the office and I got phone calls of wet basements and wet crawl spaces and show up. And sure enough, the downspout extension was off or the gutters completely blocked with the little whirly gigs from the tree seeds. And it's just amazing how quickly the gutters can block up. So, yeah, and we've got some nice warm days. It's a good time to get out and enjoy them and kind of walk around the outside of the house. Okay, does the grade slope away from the house? Water will run downhill. So you have to make sure that you've got your grading around the outside of the house correct so that the water gets out and away. So while I try and mention that every time, it gets a little old once in a while, but it's still very important. You have to make sure that grading is out and that the water from your roof is getting out and away. Champaign-Urbana has a reputation of having wet basements and wet crawl spaces. And but quite honestly, it's really not due to a high water table. We don't have the water coming up from underground in most cases. There's a few perched water tables where we've got a layer of clay that will hold water, particularly after some of the big rains that we had a month or so ago. So there are some areas where the water will it effectively create a high water table, but it's not a true water table. It's more of a perched water table. And getting the groundwater away will generally cure that.
Mm-hmm. And for in terms of slope, and I think that is it like you want 10 inches and 3-4 feet away?
As a general good rule, and it's actually in the 1 and 2 family dwelling, the BOCA code, indicates that from the bottom of the siding to your landscaping or soil should be 4 to 6 inches. So you should actually see part of your foundation. Mm-hmm. From that point to a point extending out 10 feet from the house, you should have another 6 to 8 inches of drop. In areas where you do not have 10 feet to a property line, you should still maintain the 6 to 8 inches of drop. So if your property line is only 3 feet away from the side of the house, we should have 6 to 8 inches of drop in that 3 feet. I would have to say that probably less than 5% of the houses in Champaign County
actually
have this slope, yeah. Even though it is listed in the residential building code. But that is the type of thing that will make a big difference. You look at an older farmhouse, and there's 5 to 6 steps going to the front door. Well, that's because they built the foundations up out of the ground. They can get some soil up around it, and we can get things dried out. You look at the stuff we've got nowadays, and we've got 1 or 2 steps maximum. Some of the construction that was done in the area, we actually have no steps, where it's on a concrete slab, and everything just runs right to the door there. And can't get much slope away from that.
Yeah. So even if you – I suppose a thing that you could do is you could get somebody to haul in some dirt and you could do what you can to put it around the house to establish some slope. But also you don't want dirt up against the foundation of the house.
Well, you want it up against the foundation. You don't want it up against the siding. You want to leave a little bit of an air gap there, particularly with a vinyl siding where we get some airflow moving behind the vinyl siding. Sun hits the siding, the air behind it warms up, the warm air goes up, and we need to get some cool air in from the bottom so we don't get moisture buildup back there. So, yeah, keep the soil level or your mulch, gravel, etc., several inches down below the bottom of the siding.
Mm-hmm. And painting, just where we are now getting at the time where temperatures are going to be warm enough, so if you're going to do exterior painting, we're going to be into the time where we're going to say, okay, go for it. Are we now at the point where the overnight temperatures are warm enough so that you could start thinking about painting?
And we still have a fairly high humidity level, so yeah, you need to make sure that the temperature that night is not going to drop. Well, let's face it, it is Champaign County. We don't necessarily have an even temperature. Tomorrow it may be 30. Today it may be 80. So you kind of keep an eye on things. Part of the problem with exterior painting is when we do get temperatures dropping below the dew point, and the dew point is relatively high this time of year. You can get dew at, say, 60 degrees because of the high humidity level. So, yeah, if the dew will help or prevent the paint from curing properly.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're just about the point. I guess we'll finish up. We haven't got any more calls. Any last thing you'd want to – others? We did check your air conditioner in your furnace. We did check your gutters, make sure your downspouts are on there. Look at grading around. I suppose it's just a good time if you haven't done it. Just walk around the outside of the house and just take a look at it and see if there's anything that seems like it's, you know, not quite right.
And also, if you've got aluminum storm windows, check and make sure that the sills are not sealed to the frame of the aluminum storm window. So when you open those storm windows up to let in a nice fresh air, that if any rain follows it in when you're not paying attention, that we don't collect in the sill. So check your aluminum storm windows. Make sure there's a weep hole or drain hole at the bottom so we're not trapping water on the windowsills.
All right. Scott Spees from the Spees Home Inspection Service. He's here once a month, always on a Monday, to talk about home maintenance. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you very much, David.